Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right. From phys.org, scientists have CT scanned thousands of natural history specimens, which you can access for free.
Ooh.
Yeah. It's kind of a big deal. They are calling this collaborative project among 18 institutions, which took over 5 years, Open Vertebrate, or OVERT, with a capital V in the middle.
Nice.
Researchers published a summary in which they reviewed the specimens that have been scanned to date, and they offer a glimpse of how the data might be used to ask new questions and spur the development of innovative technology. Hopefully not along the Dr. Moreau lines, although that seems pretty clear if you were just to be like, hey, artificial intelligence, here are some vertebrates, go hog wild.
Right, develop really us some new animals. We need a few.
Right? But it removes barriers in such a unique way because the majority of museum collections still remain behind closed doors, and they're typically only accessible to scientists who either have to travel to see them or ask that a small number of specimens be mailed on loan.
Wow.
And that's what OVERT was hoping to change, right? So what happened was between 2017 and 2023, OVERT project members took CT scans of over 13,000 specimens with representative species across the vertebrate tree of life. They were basically trying to say, like, let's plot point the rough skeleton.
Yeah, get a few of each, and then we'll get the rest later.
Exactly right. So this included more than half the genera of all amphibians, reptiles, fishes, and mammals. Now, a small number of specimens were also stained with a temporary contrast-enhancing solution. This allowed researchers to visualize some of the soft tissues, like skin, muscle, or other organs. And if you take a peek at the models, they give a pretty intimate look at internal portions of a specimen that could previously only be observed through things like destructive dissection or tissue sampling, in which we'd take a piece and it's gone forever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the goal of the project was to initially scan only specimens that have been preserved in ethyl alcohol. And that is, in fact, the bulk of the fish, reptile, and amphibian collections. Specimens that are too large for fluid preservation are also not likely to fit in a CT scanner.
I was going to ask, how do you CT scan a whale?
Well, are you familiar with Damien Hirst's art? Because the entire specimen was too big to scan with sufficient resolution. So what the researchers had to do was, quote, painstakingly take apart the skeleton, produce 3D models of each individual bone, then reassemble the physical and digital specimen, like IKEA on steroids, right?
Yeah.
So this project over has only been in the wild, pun intended, for about a year, but scientists have already used data from the project to gain some insights into the natural world. For example, Edward Stanley was conducting routine CT scans of spiny mice, and he was surprised to find their tails were covered with an internal coat of bony plates. These are called osteoderms. And before this discovery, armadillos were considered to be the only living mammals with these structures. Another study showed that a group of frogs called the pumpkin toadlets, they've become so small that the fluid-filled canals in their ears that help them balance no longer function properly, so they just crash land when they jump now, which is kind of sad.
I've seen those.
Yeah. But now we know why they're crazy.
Exactly, yeah, because you're also charting things over time, right? Another study, it was over 500 overt specimens, and what it did is it revealed frogs have lost and regained teeth more than 20 times through their evolutionary history. They're trying it, y'all. They're trying to grow teeth. Yet another study concluded that Spinosaurus, a massive dinosaur that was larger than Tyrannosaurus rex and thought to be aquatic, would actually have been a poor swimmer, so not so aquatic after all. And the list goes on. We've got insights, ideas that would have been impossible or impractical, but now we basically have this scaffold that allows us to take a broader view of evolutionary questions. And yeah, beyond science, artists have been using the 3D models to create realistic animal replicas. And Jennifer Brew, a high school teacher in Cincinnati, says it's been a game changer for her evolution unit.
She's not allowed to teach that.
Depends on what state she's in.
Oh, I got it.
According to her, quote, "I teach juniors and seniors, and I absolutely love them, but they can be a tough audience. They know when things are fake, which makes them less engaged. But using the overt models can teach concepts at an appropriate level while also maintaining the authenticity of the science."
And they may not have to go through the horror of actually cutting something open.
Oh, yeah. Seriously. If we can get rid of dissection in high school, that would be good. Here's what I want to know. Most CT scanners are in hospitals. So are they like bumping the line? Like they come to the hospital and you've been in a car wreck and you're waiting for your CT scan and the patient before you is like a taxidermied rat? Like that's going to feel weird, I think.
Well, and can I put my CT scans? Because they always give me my CT scans, but I can't look at them. They gave me the CD. I don't have the software.
Yeah. You got to have the software.
It's always a tease. Yeah.
Upload them. You're part of the genetic tree, man. You count.
Exactly. Here's my spine, everybody.
Good luck with it. All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from medicalexpress.com. It's titled, "Brainwaves Found to Travel in One Direction When Memories Are Made and the Opposite When Recalled."
I mean, that makes sense, I think.
Yeah, it just feels like so literal, doesn't
it? Yeah. It should be more complicated, yeah.
Yeah, but no, it's like if you just flip the battery, then the tool just starts working in reverse.
Rotates the other direction.
Yeah. So for most people, shifting through behaviors quickly and seamlessly is a mundane part of everyday life. But for neuroscientists, it's one of the brain's most remarkable capabilities. That's because different activities require the brain to use different combinations of its many regions and billions of neurons. How it manages to do this so rapidly has been an open question for decades. In a paper published on March 8th in Nature Human Behavior, a team of researchers led by Joshua Jacobs, associate professor of biomedical engineering at Columbia Engineering, shed new light on this question. By carefully monitoring neural activity of people who were recalling memories or forming new ones, the researchers managed to detect how a newly appreciated type of brainwave, traveling waves, influences the storage and retrieval of memories. The paper's co-author Uma R. Mohan, a postdoctoral researcher at NIH and former postdoctoral researcher at Columbia Engineering, said, "Broadly, we found that waves tended to move from the back of the brain to the front while patients were putting something into their memory. When patients were later searching to recall the same information, those waves moved in the opposite direction from the front towards the back of the brain," she said. In the brains of some of the study's 93 participants, waves traveled in other directions. Mohan said, "There was a lot of diversity across patients, so we implemented a framework based on the direction of an individual's oscillations, which they preferred to travel. By measuring the direction that a person's brain waves move, we may be able to predict their behavior." And if I'm understanding this correctly, it also seems that the default direction is different, and that even though they are different, when you're recalling versus storing memories, they still reverse directions too.
Yeah, it's like being right or left-handed.
Yeah. So brainwaves are patterns of electrical oscillations that reflect the state of hundreds or thousands of individual neurons at a particular moment. Researchers who study brainwaves have tended to treat them as a stationary phenomenon that occurs in a particular region, but in this study, Mohan and her colleagues contribute to a growing understanding of these oscillations differently as traveling waves that spread across the brain's cortex, the outermost layer that supports higher cognitive processing. Mohan compares the traveling waves to the ripples that would spread outward after a pebble was thrown into a pond. This relatively new way of understanding brainwaves is an exciting step in neuroscience because it offers a pathway to explaining how the brain quickly coordinates activity and shares information across multiple regions. The study drew on data from participants who were being treated for drug-resistant epilepsy at hospitals across the United States. The experiments occurred while the participants had grids or strips of electrodes temporarily implanted on the surface of the brain to determine where the patient's seizures arise. For the researchers, these electrodes offer the chance to perform experiments that wouldn't otherwise be feasible.
I wonder to what degree these studies are going to be skewed because they're only ever looking at people with epilepsy. Like, yep, epileptic brains may be functioning completely differently in general.
Yeah, very true.
But then you can't just take your average person and be like, we're going to put some implants on your brain just for a study. Like, agree to that. Mm-hmm. No one's going to do it.
I bet we can get some of the people who are signing up to be Neuralink participants.
There you go.
To sign up for this. Yeah, you know, they're out there.
Right, yeah,
they're
eager.
We just need to get them in the right place because most of the monkeys that Neuralink was implanted into have died. So
are they out there?
Yeah.
Not for long.
Yeah. So as traveling waves are increasingly well understood, they could be the basis for a new class of diagnostic tools that recognize abnormal patterns in brain activity. And there's also significant therapeutic potential. Moen explained, if someone's waves are moving in the wrong direction when they're about to try to remember something, if you could apply stimulation in the right way, you could maybe push those waves to move in a different direction, bringing about a fundamentally different memory state.
Oh, I see how it's being used for nefarious purposes.
Super memory. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or changing people's memories.
Right. Yeah. It's programming.
Mm-hmm. I mean, getting very big Havana syndrome vibes here. But, you know, when I think about nerve information traveling, that feels very analogous in a way to me, where it's like, you know, it goes all the way up the body and it's kind of this whole process thing. But especially very wild to think that, you know, we might have, I don't know, brainwave guns in the near future. Medical purposes only.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Of course.
Definitely. Yeah.
Eternal sunshine of the spotless mind.
Yeah. Next link.
Next link.
This comes from the conversation. Where does lightning strike? New map pinpoints 36.8 million yearly ground strike points in unprecedented detail.
Whoa.
So who loves looking at maps? This guy. Lightning flashes in thunderstorms at least 60 times per second somewhere around the planet, sometimes even near the North Pole. Each giant spark of electricity travels through the atmosphere at nearly 200,000 miles an hour. It's hotter than the surface of the sun and delivers 1,000 times more electricity than the power outlet that charges your smartphone. Stuff I'm sure you already knew, but did you know that lightning kills or injures about 250,000 people around the world every year?
Wow.
Most frequently in developing countries where many people work outside. My grandfather was one of those many, many, many years ago.
He got struck by lightning?
The tree got struck and it killed him.
Oh, wow.
In like 1940. I found his death certificate not too long ago and it just said, struck by lightning.
Wow.
It was something I was taught since I was born. Like, nope, go back inside.
Yeah, that becomes a family story for sure. Like, no one goes out in the rain anymore.
So in the United States, an average of 28 people were killed by lightning every year between 2006 and 2023. Each year, insurance pays about $1 billion in claims for lightning damage and around 4 million acres of land burn in lightning-caused wildfires. Yet, estimates of U.S. lightning strikes have varied widely, from about 25 million a year, a number meteorologists have cited since the 1990s, to 40 million a year, reported by Centers of Disease Control and Prevention. So quite the discrepancy.
Yeah.
It seems like they were just kind of shooting from the hip there, which led the author of this article, who is also a meteorologist, and his colleagues to use 6 years of data from a lightning detection network that they believe has become precise enough to offer a more accurate picture of lightning strikes in the U.S. To get a clearer picture of how often lightning strikes, it helps to define what a lightning strike actually is. So a lightning flash is all the cloud-to-ground lightning that occurs within 1 second in a 6 mile radius. Each flicker is a lightning stroke. Each stroke can hit one or more ground strike points. And there can be many multiple strokes in the same channel. All right, that's a little weird. In the picture, they show just one giant flash in the sky, but there are five lightning bolts hitting the ground with a bunch of outward branches.
I mean, I think they count, because if one of the little forks hit you, you still got hit. They count as separate strikes.
So where does this happen most often? In the Gulf Coast, but especially Florida. Because the basic ingredients for thunderstorms are warm and moist air near the ground with cooler, drier air above it and a way to lift the warm air up. So the Miami-Fort Lauderdale area had over 120,000 strikes in 2023. If there's not more of a reason to leave Florida.
Yeah.
However, the cool waters of the Pacific Ocean, meanwhile, tend to mean that few thunderstorms happen in the West Coast. So you're wondering, how do they count all the lightning? When lightning flashes, it acts as a giant radio antenna that sends electromagnetic waves, radio waves, around the world at the speed of light. If you have an AM radio station on during the thunderstorms, you may hear a lot of static.
Hmm.
If you're 80 years old and have an AM radio station. The National Lightning Detection Network uses strategically placed antennas to listen for these radio waves produced by lightning.
Oh.
It's now able to locate at least 90% of the cloud-to-ground lightning that occurs across the U.S. So what's the point of collecting all this data other than it just looks really cool? Meteorologists and emergency management teams can use this data to better understand how lightning typically affects their region. That can help them better forecast and prepare the public for risk hazards.
And it can decide how much the insurance company is going to charge you for your fire hazard.
Yeah, they didn't put that part in there, but you are absolutely right. That's really where most of this is going to go. So lightning is still dangerous and unpredictable, so stay safe out there. And despite the saying, lightning can and will strike in the same place twice.
Yeah, I've heard it's actually more likely because the whole reason it struck that place was it was tall and, you know, more likely to get struck. I think it's, don't stand under trees, y'all.
Just don't stand under trees. And if you go to the article, there's some awesome maps that show you the intensity of the ground strikes all over the nation, giving you kind of some data points to look at. And again, for a map nerd, it's just one more cool map to look at.
Yeah, you can like find out historically if your house has been struck before.
And if you're on the Gulf Coast, the chances are,
answer is yes. Yeah.
Yes, it did at some point in time. Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, we've got another question to be answered in the What If series by XKCD. And this time the question is, would a submarine work as a spaceship? And the short answer is, of course, no, but not for the reasons you might expect. So the first big test for any spacecraft is withstanding the vacuum of space. And it turns out that, actually, a submarine could handle that just fine. Submarines are built to withstand 50 to 80 atmospheres of pressure from water, so they'd have no problem containing the one atmosphere of pressure that the people inside it would find most comfortable. It's also safe to say that the watertight hull would also be airtight. There are some cases where something that is watertight isn't technically airtight, but again, being watertight to 50 atmospheres is going to be airtight to one atmosphere. Submarines are also designed, just like spaceships, to scrub CO2 out of the air and keep it breathable. And since submarines often submerge for months at a time, we know that these scrubbers could keep working pretty much indefinitely as long as they maintained power. Oxygen, on the other hand, is another story.
Mm-hmm.
The main way that a submarine generates new oxygen is through electrolysis, or using electricity to split water into hydrogen and oxygen. But of course, that only works because submarines are generally surrounded by water. Astronauts have to bring O2 tanks up with them. And while a submarine is equipped with a few days' worth of O2 tanks just in case, they would have to bring quite a bit more than normal if they were being launched into space. But, you know, that's still surmountable, right? They could plan for that. Now, however, we start getting into some real problems, the first of which is overheating. And this is actually a problem with spacecraft as well, because there are three main ways that an object can dissipate heat: conduction, convection, and radiation. Now, the first two are really just opposite sides of the same coin, where energy is transferred to air, water, or another substance passing over the surface. This is why a breeze cools us faster than still air, and also why you will freeze much faster in cold water than you will in air that is the same temperature. But in a vacuum, conduction and convection effectively don't happen, and all you're left with is radiation, which is actually pretty inefficient. And when you're inside an airtight ship, it's kind of like being inside a giant travel mug, right? Except unlike your hot coffee, the humans inside didn't just start out being warm, they are actively generating heat with their bodies, which is going to happen faster than the ship can dissipate it without taking deliberate measures to dump that heat. And spaceships do have mechanisms to deal with this, but submarines do not, because they are used to relying on the conduction of the cold seawater around them. What's more, a standard submarine isn't just carrying humans. It's also carrying a 200-megawatt nuclear reactor to power the engine. And while detailed specs are classified, our best estimate here is that about half of that energy is lost as heat. So without the seawater to help with that, it's enough to warm the entire submarine by about half a degree Celsius per minute, which would theoretically become deadly to humans in about an hour and a half. I say theoretically because seawater is also used to cool the nuclear reaction itself. So what would actually happen if you took water out of the equation is the reactor would rapidly melt down, killing everyone inside.
That was going to be my guess.
But let's say you brought your own cooling mechanism for the reactor and you retrofitted the sub with the same kind of heat dissipators that spaceships have. Now we've got to figure out how this sub is going to re-enter the atmosphere. And one of the key requirements for coming out of orbit is slowing down. A spaceship would do this with reverse thrust, but a submarine doesn't have that kind of propulsion. What a submarine does have, however, are ballistic missiles. Firing the missiles in the right direction wouldn't do much because their inertial effect would end as soon as they lost contact with the submarine. But if you turned the missiles around in their tubes and blasted their rockets backwards, presumably also turning off the detonators, each missile could slow the submarine's orbit by about 4 meters per second. A typical deorbiting maneuver requires slowing down by about 100 meters per second, which means the 24 Trident missiles typically carried by an Ohio-class submarine might be just enough to get the job done.
Except for the melty part.
Right. It's a little warm, but, you know. Now, because the submarine has no heat-dissipating ablative tiles and the shape is not aerodynamically stable at hypersonic velocities, it would undoubtedly break up in the atmosphere upon reentry. But, at least according to XKCD, it is theoretically possible that if you tucked yourself into the most structurally sound corner of the submarine and somehow had an acceleration couch to strap into and then had a way to eject yourself at the last second and a parachute to get you down the last several hundred feet, there is a tiny, tiny chance you might survive.
That was a lot of hypotheticals.
Yeah, all of which is to say, we should probably stick with rocket ships. Like, I do appreciate, though, when you take these ridiculous questions and discover that, you know, it's not as bad as you think. All you got to do is, like, turn the missiles around in their silos and shoot yourself.
Or, hey, submarines are actually worse than you were led to believe, if that whole kerfuffle from a few months ago wasn't enough to change your mind about it.
I mean, you know, they're not like planes. The doors aren't ripping off. We can, you know.
You can even drive them with a PlayStation controller.
That's true. Some, for a little while, anyway. All right, next link.
Next link.
Okay, from New Atlas, pulling gold out of e-waste suddenly becomes super profitable.
Oh.
Yeah. And believe it or not, it's all thanks to food industry byproduct.
Okay.
Well, that's good, because I was assuming it was going to be just caustic as hell.
It might still be. Some of our food's not great, y'all.
I guess that's true. It's true.
It's new. We have yet to understand the long-term ramifications. But for now, let's just be excited at the novelty because,
sure.
Listen, financially speaking, the ROI is clear. This new method for recovering high-purity gold from discarded electronics is paying back about $50 US for every dollar spent. That's according to researchers who found the key gold-filtering substance in cheese-making, of all places. Now, society, we love our gold more recently for technical applications, but like any metal, gold is a non-renewable resource.
Yeah, I gotta be honest, I like my cheese more than I like gold, if we're just asking me. Like,
listen, it's a byproduct of the cheese-making industry. You don't gotta choose. That's what's
right.
So
I have to eat more
this.
Cheese is what I'm hearing.
Like, That's right. The food industry byproduct is whey from curds and whey nursery rhyme fame. What they did is under acidic conditions and high temperatures, they denatured the whey proteins. That means the deconstruction of the protein structure into something that's more loose and more random. And that caused them to aggregate into nanofibrils in a gel. They then dried the gel, basically made it into a big old sponge. So then the researchers extracted the metal parts from 20 old computer motherboards, dissolved them in an acid bath to ionize the metals or separate them into positive and negative ions. Then they took that protein fibril sponge, put it in the metal ion solution, and boom, the gold ions stuck to it. So once they had this gold ion soaked cheese sponge, they then subjected it to heat, reducing the ions to flakes, which eventually melted down into a gold nugget with a mass around 500 milligrams. Now, analysis revealed the nugget was made predominantly of gold. We're talking 90% of its weight. So the purity of the nugget was pretty high. It would correspond to about 21 or 22 carats.
Not bad.
Yeah. So in the paper, the researchers demonstrated their method's commercial viability. They cited source material procurement costs and the energy costs for the entire process. Total cost of recovering 1 gram of gold from e-waste was 50 times lower than the value of the gold recovered. But they're ready to get this technology on the market. Where's the trace gold? We got cheese sponges at the ready, right?
Yeah, I'm ready to do my part. Give me the cheese and I'll give you all my leftover whey.
Starship Troopers, but cheese edition. I'm doing my part. Yum, yum, yum. All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from futurism.com. Bit of a short one. It's titled, "A Scientist's Proposed Desperate Plan to Insulate Entire Doomsday Glacier."
Oh, gosh.
Like a sweater?
kind of.
Okay.
The subtitle is, "It's a $50 billion Hail Mary," which I'm not sure if hail is a pun or not. But... So the Thwaites Doomsday Glacier is melting, and I believe it's called that because it's about the size of Florida, and it's an ice shelf in western Antarctica, which contains so much water that it would cause sea levels to rise by 2 feet on its own if it were to collapse. So fearing that current efforts to slow global warming won't be enough, geoengineers led by John Moore, a glaciologist at the University of Lapland in Finland, have proposed a grandiose and perhaps desperate plan to prevent the Thwaites from melting, surrounding the glacier with enormous 62-mile-long curtains to keep out the warm water. So, yes, it is a sweater.
Oh, wow.
The research is still in its early stages, but it's already clear that such a proposal would be a monumental undertaking, costing a staggering $50 billion, according to Moore's estimate. He says, "It sounds like a hell of a lot, but compare the risk. Mm-hmm. The cost of sea level protection around the world, just coastal defenses, is expected to be about $50 billion per year per meter of sea level rise." So, what's primarily causing the doomsday ice sheet to melt is the warming of the ocean currents that batter it, rather than the ambient temperature of the region.
That's your opinion, man.
Sorry. Yeah. So 90% of global warming, in fact, takes place in the ocean, with a link to more reading, in case anybody thought that Bradley was not joking.
Right.
Moore had previously proposed building a wall in the surrounding Amundsen Sea to divert the warm currents. Since 2020, however, he's favored seabed-anchored curtains because they could be cheaper to implement, and most of all, reversible should they have unexpected consequences, which is actually an incredible amount of forethinking.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of time, it's just like, let's blot out the sun. What if it doesn't work? I don't know.
Throw the sulfur in the air. Who cares? Yeah. It'll probably be fine.
Yeah. So, any intervention should be something that you can revert if you have second thoughts, Moore says. So Moore and a team of researchers at the University of Cambridge are currently testing a 3-foot-long prototype in water tanks. In about 2 years, the goal is to scale up to a 33-foot-long curtain that they'll test in a Norwegian fjord. So the proposal has been met with criticism from scientists in the past. In general, they argue that it's a band-aid solution that distracts from addressing the ultimate problem of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, never mind the logistical challenges of building such a colossal structure. But Moore argues that action needs to be taken now. In his view, we won't be able to reduce emissions quickly enough to save the pivotal ice sheet. Research has shown that massive cracks are appearing in the Thwaites Glacier, and they could accelerate its melting, meaning its collapse could come sooner than we thought. He told Business Insider, "The glacier doesn't really care anymore about what humans want to do about their emissions. At that point, that's when you need these other tools in the box."
Yeah, and the Band-Aid on it. Well, yeah, it's a Band-Aid.
Yeah,
but it also needs a Band-Aid, too. When you cut yourself, you kind of need a Band-Aid, and also stop cutting.
Yeah, you don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. You have to try something.
Yeah, apply 63 miles of pressure. That'll
say yes to ocean sweater. Do it!
Yeah.
And what it would do, though, this is where I'm ignorant, but what wildlife is actually existing underneath that? How will it affect that? But I guess we don't know until we try.
Yeah, but also putting up a giant seawall around New York City, that's going to affect the ecology, too. Like, we're going to be building 100%. Walls one way or the other, I think.
You know what's going to happen is we're going to replace glaciers with these ocean sweaters so polar bears will be able to sustain their populations again.
That's right. They'll look adorable as they're mauling you.
Next link.
Next link.
Speaking of heat, this comes from Science Alert. Startling exception discovered to 200-year-old law of physics. Known as Fourier's law, it describes how heat is transferred or conducted through solid materials. As molecules vibrate and electrons shuttle about, the heat diffuses from the hotter end of an object to the colder end at a rate that is proportional to the temperature difference and the area through which heat flows.
Mm-hmm.
However, in the past few decades, researchers have found that on the nanoscale, this model of diffusion doesn't work, as is the case with many things
yeah.
at the nanoscale. Polymer physicist Kaikai Zhang from the University of Massachusetts Amherst and colleagues wondered if there might be similar exceptions to be found at the macro scale, specifically in see-through materials like translucent polymers. Being translucent, these materials let some wavelengths of light pass through. Although the light doesn't totally get absorbed like opaque materials, it does scatter, bouncing off impurities in the material structure. This led Zhang to hypothesize that as well as heat diffusing through these solid materials, their translucence might also allow heat energy to travel through the materials in the form of thermal radiation as well. So the researchers clamped strips of test materials and suspended them one by one inside a custom-made vacuum chamber. The team then fired a laser for a split second at the materials to heat them up and measured how heat spreads through each of the materials using three methods: a temperature sensor placed directly on the material surface, measuring the color change of the temperature-sensitive coating painted onto the sample, and an infrared camera. The data showed heating occurred faster than can be attributed to diffusion. The team suggests that translucent materials radiate heat internally because structural imperfections act as heat absorbers and sources. Their findings could help engineers design new strategies for heat management in translucent materials.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like if we make the submarine clear, that changes things. Like, that helps.
Yeah, it helps. Every fish in the ocean can watch you wet your pants the deeper you go.
That would be so fun, though. Like, it's like a glass-bottom boat, but all around, I don't know. I'd be on board.
Well, hopefully it means that they'll figure out better ways to stop heat from getting through glass.
Your practical uses, fine.
Yeah. Next link.
Next link.
All right, well, I've got a short but visually interesting one here from Aeon.co called "Is It Possible to Design a Shape to Roll Along Any Fixed Path?" And like I said, it's very visual. There's a whole video at the site that makes it all make sense, but I'll do my best to do it in words. Basically, we start with the idea that different shapes roll in different ways, right? A cylinder will go down a ramp, but a cone will swoop in a big arc, and something asymmetrical like an egg will swerve all over the place. But what if you're trying to achieve a specific wobbly path? And we'll get into the reasons why you might want to do that a little later, but math nerds are all about seeing what you can figure out for the sake of figuring it out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out one easy way to make a shape that will follow a specific path is to start with a lump of clay, draw the path you want it to take down the ramp, and then manually roll the ball down that crooked line with your palm, pressing down a little as you go so you make the exact right indentations and lumps in the ball that will make it swerve when and where it's supposed to.
I'm doing science. I'm not playing with Play-Doh, I promise.
Exactly. And then assuming you can find the contact point on the clay where it first started at the top of the line, you can let it go and it will hopefully follow the path you shaped it for. But another way to envision the ball rolling down the line is to imagine the line wrapped around the ball. So these aforementioned math nerds developed an algorithm that lets you map your desired path onto the surface of a sphere, and it can then calculate the lumps or dips or whatever is needed to make sure that line is always touching the ground as it goes along.
Ooh.
And if you adjust the size of the ball and the layout of the line correctly such that the ending point is also the starting point, you can then 3D print a little asymmetrical lump of plastic that will roll in a visually random-looking but entirely repeatable path of pretty much any design.
Ooh, Rube Goldberg potential.
Yeah,
I mean, they do have to take a lot of things. Like, there's a bunch of stuff of, like, the ramp can only be so steep and it can only make sharp turns of a certain angle. And quite a lot of the video is just watching these weird lumps slowly roll down ramps exactly along a squiggly path. It's honestly incredibly satisfying to watch. Like, the predictable randomness of the movement, it almost makes them take on a lifelike quality. Like, they're jumping around like little creatures. I don't know. You just got to watch these balls. It's adorable. As for why any of this matters, quantum states of a particle are often represented as points on the surface of a sphere. And a series of changes from one state to the next can be equated to a random-looking squiggly line across the surface. And, you know, the physical shape of a lump in the real world isn't the same as the energy state of a particle, but the researchers do think that there may be some crossover that can be applied when it comes to both predicting and generating quantum state changes based on what we've learned at the macro level. So there you have it. You know, math covers a lot of things in this world, and one of those things is apparently making little lumpy balls that roll down ramps.
Well, I also thought there could be a practical usage if you had, like, a sliding door that had all sorts of weird angles to it that normally had a lot of friction as you go over those parts. You could design a wheel
that was
almost frictionless on those weird angles.
Yeah, if it was like one exact period of the roll from open to closed.
From just one part to the other part, but it was a weird angle. That's kind of the practical outside of getting into particle physics.
I mean, you could also get your contractor to make the door square, but let's be honest, that's not going to happen. So
two more weeks, it's a little more expensive than we budgeted.
Right. All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include The Magic of Bird Brains, Death Care Has Turned into a Gold Rush, and When It Comes to Exploring Space, We're Still Stuck in the Stone Age. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Weisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.